You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 18th to the 24th of January 2018. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by news editor Chris Havergal, reporter Rachel Pells and books editor Matthew Rice. Experts fear that the crackdown on academic freedom in Turkey will be followed by a drive towards the Islamization of campuses after the country's president accused one of its top universities of failing to lean on national values. That's our lead news story this week, and Chris will take us through it in just a moment. Matthew has been speaking to several academic moonlighters, scholars whose work strays well beyond disciplinary boundaries. Why would a biochemist write a paper on the novelist Iris Murdoch? Why would a literary scholar start advising people on the use of antidepressant drugs? Find out a little bit later in the podcast. And what happens if you hide a wedding proposal in the footnotes of your research paper? Rachel will have the answer coming up. But first, Chris, our lead news story this week is written by our Europe reporter, David Matthews. He's based out there, so he's not in the room with us. As news editor, you can step in, I'm sure, and take us through it. It concerns the somewhat beleaguered higher education sector in Turkey under President Erdogan.
Yeah, the problems of Turkey's higher education sector have been well known and widely covered ever since a failed coup in 2016. Since then, thousands of academics have been arrest or dismissed. There have also been the closure of several universities, and many academics have had travel bans imposed on them under suspicion that they were somehow supporters of the coup or indeed of the Kurdish separatist movement. What our lead story this week does is look at a speech given by President Erdogan at one of Turkey's major universities, Boğaziçi University, and asking whether his complaint that universities were failing to, in his words, lean on national values, is a sign that this persecution of academia in Turkey is moving into a new phase, moving from a simple crackdown on academic freedom to something that looks much more like the Islamization of campuses. David's spoken to a number of academics, either in the country or outside it, who have suggested some of the directions that this could, potentially take to Turkish universities in. One academic suggested that if this is indeed a sort of an Islamization agenda, you could see the introduction of prayer spaces, gender segregated canteens, and restrictions on women's dress, as well as more teaching of theology and the banning of teaching of Darwinism and evolution from campus curricula. So it's it's a worrying time for Turkish academics, and I think people will be watching closely to see whether this already troubled sector it is in line for more difficulties in the years ahead.
And it's a difficult sort of picture to write about, isn't it? A lot of people actually in the country quite reluctant to be drawn on issues. It's sort of quite a challenge to piece together how people there are feeling. We've had multiple opinion pieces from Turkish academics, usually based outside Turkey, such is the feeling within the country that people don't really want to step out of line.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. I mean, one thing that President Erdogan has been sort of quite specific about is the use of English in teaching. He's specifically criticised Boğaziçi and Galatasaray University. Galatasaray University teaches in French. He suggested they were being held back because they weren't teaching in Turkish. In terms of the broader strategy, you're right to say it's sort of difficult from this distance and in a situation where people are reluctant to speak out, to judge how much of a Islamization strategy there is going on here and how much of this is more of the sort of bullying approach that we've seen of the last 18 months being continued. Nevertheless, I think the end result probably will still be pretty similar in that, all of these things, be it about which language you sort of use as your language of academia, or indeed the sorts of things that you allow academics to talk and write about, is likely to sort of add to the difficulties of the sector and in particular damage its international standing and the links which it holds with other universities around the world.
Indeed, you can read that story on the news pages in this week's magazine. You'll also find it, of course, on timeshighereducation.com. I should mention that our cover feature this week looks at the first year of Donald Trump in the White House. Our correspondent John Morgan has travelled out to the University of California, Berkeley, of course a key battleground in the campus culture wars, to assess the mood towards US higher education and the threats that that sector faces. So don't miss out on that one. And the other feature this week, Matthew, is one of yours. You've been looking at academic moonlighters.
Yes. Well, this is people like a woman called Rivka Isaacson, who's a biochemist, runs her own lab, and she happens to always read a lot of fiction, and she happened to be interested in the novels of Iris Murdoch. She joined the Iris Murdoch Society and sort of was chatting to people there and say, oh, and somebody said, well, why don't you write a paper for us? And she thought, well, that's a strange idea. But then she thought, well, why not? There was no reason not to. What had she got to lose? And, of course, she went along, and her sort of lecturing style was rather different from what's used. They were used to in literary studies. She created an animation of all the sort of permutations and combinations of sexual couplings in some of Iris Murdoch's novels, and sort of just improvised around that. And then all the other papers were extremely formal, written in advance, and people made a point of saying quote and unquote at the right point. So she, there was a kind of culture clash, but she found it...
Mixing it up a bit.
Yeah, indeed. And then another case, a guy called Leonard Davis, he was an expert on the early English novel, and he happens to be the child of deaf parents, and he was once invited as a journalist at a conference about children of deaf parents. He thought it was the stupidest idea he'd ever heard of. You know, that some will be black, some will be white, some will be rich, poor, Republicans, Democrats, they'd have nothing in common. It was a really silly idea. He was all poised to write a really satirical article about it. And then he went along and actually realised that the fact that he was a child of a deaf parents was really quite central to his identity. Right. So he started writing about deafness, disability, what we mean by normality, and eventually even wrote the point where he got to the point where he wrote a blog discouraging people from taking the antidepressant drugs known as SSRIs, even though he has no medical training. So it's about people who leap the bounds and try and make serious contributions to disciplines very far removed from their own.
The intro to the article says such moonlighters are often seen as unusual, viewed with suspicion. Did you get a sense that there was any snobbery or a lack of a welcoming attitude towards people trying to transcend these boundaries?
Well, I think there are two things. One is people say, why are you wasting your time on that? You should be concentrating on the day job. And also, obviously if you put on a CV, you've written five journal articles about thermodynamics and one about Iris Murdoch, people think this looks a bit weird. but you have to be pretty dedicated and energetic. But I think that some people said it was just fun. Some said that they thought that disciplines, needed to be broken down a bit anyway. And the other thing is that some people made the claim that actually outsiders to disciplines can kind of see things which people who are kind of totally brought up within a particular discipline don't notice, the sort of unspoken assumptions and so on, so that they can actually stir things up in an interesting way.
Is there a sense, though, that you have to be quite a senior academic to be able to do this? I mean, presumably a lot of these people are professors. If they're sort of an early career researcher trying to have feet in sort of two camps, as it were, they presumably find it more difficult.
I think it is easier as you get on and are established. I think it's probably easier in some ways in America if you've got tenure. Because although it might, if you want a raise or something, it's good to contribute to your own discipline. You're not actually required to produce four articles or something.
Mm, indeed. Well, while we've got you here, Matthew, I should say that's on page 45 of the magazine and online too. But while we've got you here in your role as books editor rather than feature writer extraordinaire, take us through some of the highlights from this week's books.
Well, I think the one I really want to flag up is the book of the week, which is a book called You Don't Own Me, which is about the dispute between Mattel and MGA Entertainment about Barbie, the Barbie doll, and then the competitor called Bratz.
I remember
Bratz. Described as a modern, voluptuous, multi-ethnic doll. So there was a lot of argy-bargy about this. And so on a one level, it's a dispute about intellectual property, and indeed written by a woman with a background in the law. But it obviously raises all sorts of interesting issues about body image and corporate malpractice. So it's a very entertaining review of what's clearly a very entertaining book.
Indeed. Click the books tab on the homepage to read that one. Moving on, Rachel, the most read story on our website this week by some distance was all about an unorthodox wedding proposal.
Yeah, this is a great story. A PhD student from China, he left a wedding a marriage proposal to his partner in the acknowledgements of his paper, which is a pretty bold move, I think, because his paper is called Performance Analysis for Minimally Nonlinear Irreversible Refrigerators at Finite Cooling Power. And that's pretty specialist. So
Nothing says romance like refrigerators.
Yeah. I just don't know if that was my partner, whether I could guarantee that I'd read it all the way through. I mean, she did. He confirmed. He sent an email back to us saying that Pan Pan did say yes to the proposal. So it's a happy story.
Oh, sweet.
Excellent. Yeah. You've also been writing, on a somewhat more serious note, may I say, this week, about a change from a left to right-wing leadership in Chile. President Piñera now in control there, and how that could have dramatic consequences for universities there.
Yeah, it's really interesting and a lot more complicated, obviously. Chile is quite unusual in that it has a social mobility scheme called Gratuidad, which enables free education for now 60% of the student population, the 60% with the lower income. That was put in place under the last president, who was a lot more left-leaning. The new president's quite right-wing, so there have been concerns that this scheme will be changed. He's spoken in the past about, he's very keen on privatisation of the sector, which obviously a lot of people disagree with. But on the other hand, I've had some responses from other scholars in Chile already saying that actually the system is well in need of reform, so it's a very complicated picture.
Indeed. You can read that analysis on page 19 of the magazine on timeshighereducation.com as well. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you do wish to comment on anything that we've discussed, you can find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. You'll find us on LinkedIn too, and on Facebook as well. And of course, you'll find us at timeshighereducation.com. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.